addressing Pinot's three pursuers, who joined the tenor on the stage.
"We're after a traitor," one of the men said.
4. Pinot pushed through the door, and it made an ear-splitting squeak. He took off again, across a landing, down the stairs, and into the lobby. The doors were open. He jogged out, tearing off his shirt, which left him in a sleeveless white t-shirt. He glanced to his left. Home was only 5 or 6 blocks away. But he couldn't go there and risk jeopardizing his family. Instead, he went straight across the trolley tracks and into a knot of people celebrating the end of the war around the statue of Leonardo da Vinci. He tried to stay focused, but in his head he kept hearing the clown's devastated aria, kept seeing Anna crying for help, hunching up at the bullet strike, and then crumpling. It took everything he had not to lie down and dissolve into sobs. It took everything he had to put on a smiling face, as if he, too, were overjoyed by the Nazis' retreat. He kept it up through the galleria, smiling and moving, not quite sure where he was going. Then he stepped free of the shopping mall and knew. A huge crowd was celebrating on Piazza Duomo, eating, drinking, playing music and dancing. Pinot melted into them, slowing, smiling, and trying to look normal, as he moved toward the trickle of people heading into the cathedral to pray. To Pinot, the Duomo meant sanctuary. They could chase him inside the cathedral, but they couldn't bring him out. He was almost to the front doors when he heard a man shouting behind him,
"There he is! Stop him! He's a traitor! A collaborator!"
Pinot looked back and saw them coming across the piazza. Following several women old enough to be his mother, he slipped into the basilica. 5. With the stained glass windows boarded over, the only light in the Duomo came from votive candles flickering in the various alcoves and chapels to either side of the cathedral's central aisle, and more burning at the far end around the altar. Even with the candles, the inner cathedral was a charcoal-shadowed place that day, and Pinot acted swiftly to take advantage of it. He moved away from the chapels on the Duomo's left side, heading toward the right aisle and the confessionals, bleak affairs offering no privacy to the penitent, who knelt outside a tall wooden box and whispered their sins to the priest inside. It was humiliating, and Pinot hated going to confession there. But from his times kneeling at the Duomo confessionals as a young boy, he knew there was a space between the booth and the wall, 30 centimeters, 50 at best. He hoped it would be enough as he eased behind the third confessional booth, farthest from the candle stands. He stood there, shaking, hunched down so he'd be fully hidden, and was glad that no priests seemed to be taking confessions on Liberation Day. The aria started again in his head, and with it the horror of Anna's death, until he shook it off and forced himself to listen. The clicking and murmurs of women praying the Holy Rosary came to him. A cough, the squeak of the main doors. Men talking. Pinot fought the urge to peek out and waited, hearing loud footsteps coming. Men moving fast.
"Where did he go?" one said.
"He's in here somewhere," said another, sounding like he was right in front of the confessional booth.
"I'm coming," a male voice said, amid other footsteps approaching.
"No, Father," one man said. "Not today. We're, going to one of the chapels to pray."
"If you sin on the way there, I'll be waiting," the priest said, and the door to the confessional booth opened.
Pinot felt the box settle under the priest's weight. He heard the two men move off deeper into the cathedral. He waited, hardly breathing, giving it time. Once more the clown sang in his head.
Once more he tried to will it away, but the Arya would not leave his head. He had to move, for fear he'd burst out crying again. Pino tried to step gingerly out from behind the confessional, but his toe caught the kneeler.
"Ah,"
the priest said.
"A customer at last."
The screen slid back, but all Pino could see in there was blackness. He did the only thing he could think of and knelt.
"Bless me, Father, for I have sinned," Pino choked. "Yes?"
"I said nothing," Pino sobbed in lament.
"I did nothing." "What are you talking about?"
the priest said. 6. Feeling like he might collapse if he confessed more, Pino lurched to his feet and charged deeper into the cathedral. He crossed beneath the transept and found a door he remembered. He went through it and was outside again, facing Via dell'Arcivescovado. There were more happy people walking toward the piazza. He went against the grain and looped around the back of the Duomo. He was considering going home or to Uncle Albert's when he noticed a priest and a workman come out a door on the far side of the Duomo, near Corso Vittorio. There was a staircase behind them that he remembered going up as a boy with a school class. Another workman exited. Pino caught the door before it closed and started up a steep and narrow staircase that climbed 30 stories to a walkway that ran the long side of the basilica, up there among the gargoyles, spires, and Gothic arches. He kept glancing up at the pristine, polychrome statue of the Madonna atop the Duomo's highest tower, wondering how she'd survived the war and how much destruction she'd seen. Drenched with cold sweat, shivering despite the baking heat as he moved between and under the flying buttresses that supported the roof, Pino stopped at last when he reached a balcony high above the cathedral's front doors. He looked out over his bombarded city, his bombarded life, splayed out around him like some tattered and bullet-riddled skirt. Pino lifted his head to the sky, and from an anguish that knew no bottom, whispered,
"I said nothing to save her, God. I did nothing."
Those confessions transfixed him right back into the tragedy, and he choked back sobs.
After everything, now I have nothing.
Pino heard laughter, music, and singing float up to him from the piazza. He stepped out onto the balcony and looked over the railing. 90 meters below, down where he'd seen the workmen erecting the spotlights nearly 2 years before, violins played, and accordions, and guitars. He could see the bottles of wine being passed around, and couples were beginning to kiss and dance and love on the backside of war. Pain and grief sawed through Pino. This torment was his punishment, he decided. He bowed his head, understanding that this was between God and... The aria of the heartbroken clown echoed in his ears, and Anna crumpled and fell again and again, and... In a matter of seconds, his faith in God, in life, in love, and in a better tomorrow drained away to empty. Pino held on to a marble post and climbed up onto the balcony rail. A betrayer, abandoned and alone, he gazed at the puffy clouds scudding across the azure sky and decided that clouds and sky were good enough to look at while dying.
"You saw all that I did, Lord," Pino said, letting go of the post to take the worst step of all. "Have mercy on my soul."
Chapter 31 1
Stop! A man shouted behind him.
Pino startled, almost lost his full balance, almost pitched off the railing, almost plunged 30 stories to the stone piazza and death. But his mountaineering reflexes were too ingrained. His fingers caught the post. He steadied himself enough to look over his shoulder and felt his heart try to crawl out of his chest. The Cardinal of Milan was standing there, not 3 meters away.
"What are you doing?" Schuster demanded.
"Dying," Pino said dully.
"You'll do no such thing, not in my church, and not on this day of all days," the Cardinal said. "There's been too much bloodshed already. Get down from there, young man. Now."
"Really, my Lord Cardinal, it's better this way."
"My Lord Cardinal?"
The Prince of the Church squinted, adjusted his glasses, and looked closer.
"Only one person I know calls me that. You're General Lyris's driver. You're Pino Lella."
"Which is why jumping is better than living." Cardinal Schuster shook his head, took a step toward him.
"Are you the traitor and collaborator who's supposedly hiding in the Duomo?"
Pino nodded.
"Get down, then," Schuster said, holding out his hand. "You're safe. I'm granting you sanctuary. No one will harm you under my protection."
Pino wanted to cry, but said,
"You wouldn't if you knew what I've done." "I know what Father Ray told me about you. It's enough for me to know I should save you.
Take my hand now. You're making me ill standing up there like that." Pino looked down and saw Schuster's hand and his cardinal's ring, but he did not take it.
"What would Father Ray have you do?" Cardinal Schuster said.
At that, something gave way inside Pino. He grabbed the cardinal's hand, got down, and stood there, stooped and trying not to break down. Schuster put his hand on Pino's trembling shoulder.
"It can't be all that bad, my son."
"It's worse, my Lord Cardinal," Pino said.
"The worst, the go-to-hell kind of act."
"Let me be the judge of that," Schuster said, guiding him away from the balcony. He got Pino to sit down in the shade of one of the cathedral's flying buttresses. Pino did, vaguely aware of the music still playing below, vaguely aware of the cardinal calling to someone to get food and water. Then Schuster crouched beside Pino.
"Tell me now," the cardinal said. "I will hear your confession."
Pino gave Schuster the spine of his story with Anna, how he'd met her on the street the first day of the bombardment, and then 14 months later, through General Lyris's mistress, how they'd fallen in love, and how they'd planned to marry, and how she'd tragically died in front of a firing squad, not an hour before.
"I said nothing to stop them," he wept. "I did nothing to save her."
Cardinal Schuster closed his eyes. Pino choked.
"If I really loved her, I should have been willing to die with her."
"No," the prelate said, opening his eyes and fixing them on Pino. "It is a tragedy that your Anna died that way, but you had the right to survive. Every human has that basic, God-given right, Pino, and you feared for your life."
Pino threw up his hands and cried, "Do you know how many times I've feared for my life in the last 2 years?"
I can't imagine.
Every time before, I had faith in doing the right thing, no matter the danger. But I just couldn't believe in Anna enough to...
He started to cry again. Faith is a strange creature, Schuster said. Like a falcon that nests year after year in the same place, but then flies away, sometimes for years, only to return again, stronger than ever.
I don't know if it will ever return for me.
It will, in time. Why don't you come with me now? We'll get you fed, and I'll find a place for you to spend the night. Pino thought about that, and then shook his head, saying,
I'll come off the roof with you, my Lord Cardinal, but I think I'll slip out after dark. Go home to my family.
Schuster paused and then said, As you wish, my son. Bless you, and go with God. 2. After dark, Pino slipped into the lobby of his parents' apartment building and immediately recalled the prior Christmas Eve and how Anna had played the sentries to get the suitcase with the radio transmitter safely upstairs. Riding up in the birdcage elevator provoked another round of crushing memories, how they'd kissed going past the fifth-floor guards, and how they'd... The elevator stopped. He shuffled to the door and knocked. Aunt Greta opened the door with a big grin on her face.
There you are, Pino! We've been holding dinner for you and Mario. Have you seen him?
Pino swallowed hard and said, He's dead. They're all dead. His aunt stood there in shock as he moved past her into the apartment. Uncle Albert and Pino's father heard him and were getting up from the living room couch.
What do you mean he's dead? Michele asked. A man who wanted his wristwatch called him a fascist and shot him in the head in the public gardens near Porta Venezia, Pino said dully.
No,
his father said. That's not true.
I saw it happen, Papa. His father broke down, crying.
Oh, dear God! How will I tell his mother?
Pino was staring at the living room rug, remembering how he and Anna had made love there. The best Christmas present of his life. He wasn't hearing the questions Uncle Albert was firing at him. He just wanted to lie down there and mourn and grieve. Aunt Greta stroked his arm.
It's going to be okay, Pino, she soothed. Whatever you've seen, whatever you've suffered, you're going to be okay.
Tears welled in Pino's eyes, and he shook his head.
No, I won't. Not ever.
Oh, my poor boy, she cried softly. Please come and eat. Tell us all about it.
In a wavering voice, he said,
I can't talk about it. I can't think about it anymore. And I'm not hungry. All I want to do is sleep.
He was shivering, as if it were the middle of winter again. Michele came over. Put his arm around Pino. Then we'll get you to bed. You'll feel better in the morning. Pino barely understood where he was as they led him down the hall to his bedroom. He sat on the edge of the bed, all but catatonic.
Do you want to listen to the shortwave? His father asked. It's safe now.
Father Ray has mine.
I'll get Baca's.
Pino shrugged listlessly. Michele hesitated, but then left and returned with Baca's radio. He set it on the end table.
It's there for you if you want it.
Thanks, Papa.
I'm right down the hall if you need me.
Pino nodded. 3. Michele shut the door behind him. Pino could hear him talking to Uncle Albert and Aunt Greta in worried whispers that faded to nothing. Through the open window he heard a single shot to the north, and people laughing and carrying on in the streets below. It felt like they were all taunting him with their joy, kicking him at his lowest moment. He slammed down the window. He pulled off his shoes and pants, lay down on the bed, shaking with rage and regret as he turned off the light. He tried to sleep, but was haunted not by the aria, but by the black, accusatory look Anna held on to as she died, and the love that fled from him with her soul's passing. He turned on the shortwave and tuned it until he heard a slow piano solo playing against the whisk of a drum cymbal. Soft, warm jazz. Pino closed his eyes and tried to go with the music, which was as gentle and playful as a summer stream. He tried to imagine the stream, tried to find peace in it, and sleep, and nothingness. But then the peace ended, and Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy came on. Pino sat up with a start, feeling like every twitching beat in the song was there to goad and torture him. He saw himself the night before in the Hotel Diana with Carletto playing and partying. Anna had been alive then, not yet taken by the mob. If he'd just gone by Dolly's rather than... Feeling destroyed all over again, Pino grabbed the radio and almost hurled it against the wall, intending to bust it into a thousand pieces. But all of a sudden he was so overwhelmed, so exhausted, he merely turned the dial until the radio emitted static. Pino rolled up in the fetal position. He closed his eyes, listening to the hiss and crackle of the wireless, and praying that the gaping wound in his heart was enough to stop it from beating before he awoke. 4. In Pino's dreams, Anna was alive. In his dreams, she still laughed like Anna and kissed like Anna. She smelled of her own perfume and gave him that sidelong, amused look that always got him wanting to hold her and tickle her, and... Feeling someone shaking his shoulder, he startled awake in his bedroom. Sunlight poured through the window. Uncle Albert and his father were standing by his bed. Pino looked at them as though they were strangers. "It's 10," Uncle Albert said. "You've been asleep almost 14 hours." The nightmare of the day before rushed back in. Pino so longed for sleep and the dreams where Anna still lived that he almost started to cry again. "I know this is difficult for you," Michele said. "But we need your help." Uncle Albert nodded. "We have to go look for Mario's body at Cimitero Monumentale." Pino still wanted to roll over and search for Anna in his dream, but he said, "I left him in the public gardens. I ran from his body there." Uncle Albert said, "I went to look last night after you'd gone to sleep. They said he was taken to the cemetery, and we could look for him there along with all the other bodies that have been found in the streets the past few days." "So get up," Michele said. "3 of us will find Mario quicker than 2. We owe his mother that much." "I'll be recognized," he said. "Not with me, you won't," Uncle Albert said. Pino saw there was no stopping them. "Give me a minute. I'll be right out." They left him, and he sat up, aware of the pounding in his head and the deep and vast emptiness that fluctuated between his throat and gut. His brain sought memories of Anna, but he stopped the urge. He couldn't think of her,
Otherwise, he'd just lie there and mourn. Pino put on clean clothes and walked back into the living room. "Do you want anything to eat before we go?" his father asked. "I'm fine now," Pino said, hearing the flatness in his voice and not caring. "You should at least drink some water."
"I'm fine," Pino shouted. "Are you deaf, old man?"
Michele took a step back. "Okay, Pino. I just want to help." He stared at his father, unable and unwilling to tell them about Anna. "I know, Papa," he said. "I'm sorry. Let's go find Mario." 5. 11 in the morning, and already it was stifling hot outside. Barely a breeze blew as they walked through the streets, took one of the few trams running, and then caught a ride from a friend of Uncle Albert's who'd managed to find petrol. Pino would remember little of the journey. Milan, Italy, the world itself had become unhinged for him, disjointed and savage. He watched the scarred city as if from afar, not at all a part of the teeming life that was beginning to return after the Nazis' retreat. The car dropped them in front of the cemetery piazza. Pino felt like he was in a dream-turning nightmare again as he walked toward the Famiglio, the octagonal-shaped memorial chapel of the Cimitero Monumentale, and the long, two-story, arched and opened-air colonnades that jutted off the chapel left and right. Cries of grief echoed from the colonnades before rifle shots sounded at a distance, followed by the deep, rumbling exhale of some larger explosive. Pino didn't care about any of it. He welcomed a bomb. He'd hug one and smash the primer with a hammer if he could. A dump truck honked. Uncle Albert pulled Pino out of its way. In a daze, Pino looked at the vehicle as it passed. It was like any other dump truck he'd seen, until it got upwind. The stench of death poured out. Stacked like cordwood, corpses filled the vehicle's bed. Blue and swollen bodies stuck out the top, some clothed, some naked, men, women, and children. Pino doubled over, started to dry heave and then retch. Michele rubbed his back. "It's all right, Pino. With the heat, I knew to bring us handkerchiefs and camphor." The dump truck did a 180-degree turn and backed up to the lower arches of the western colonnade. A lever was thrown. 100 or more bodies spilled out of the bed and flopped onto the gravel. Pino stopped and gaped in horror. Was Anna in there? Buried? He heard one of the drivers say that there were hundreds more bodies coming. Uncle Albert tugged Pino's arm. "Come away from there now," he said. Like an obedient dog, Pino followed them into the memorial chapel. "Are you looking for a loved one?" asked a man standing inside the door. "My cousin's son," Michele said. "He was mistaken for a fascist, and..." "I'm sorry for your loss, but I don't care why or how your cousin's son died," the man said. "I just want the body to be claimed and removed. This is an extraordinary health hazard. Do you have masks?" "Handkerchiefs and camphor," Pino's father said. "That will help." "Is there some order to the bodies?" Uncle Albert said. "The order they came in and where we found a place to lay them. You'll just have to search. Do you know what he was wearing?" "His Italian Air Force uniform," Michele said. "Then you should find him. Take those stairs. Start on the lower eastern colonnades and work your way out to the rectangular series of hallways off the main galleries." Before they could thank him, he'd already moved on to tell the next distraught family how to find its dead loved one. Michele handed out white handkerchiefs and fished the mothballs from a paper sack. He put the camphor into the center of the handkerchiefs and tied the ends to make a pouch, showed them how to press it to their lips and nose.
"I learned how to do this in the First Great War," he said.
Pino took the pouch and stared at it.
"We'll search the lower galleries," Uncle Albert said. "You start up here, Pino."
6. His mind was barely functioning as he went out an open side door on the east side of the chapel and out onto the upper floor of the colonnade. Parallel open arches hemmed the gallery some 90 meters to an octagon-shaped tower that marked a triple intersection of passages. On any other day, these halls would have been largely empty, save for the statues of long-forgotten Lombardy statesmen and members of the nobility. Now, however, the length of the colonnade and the galleries beyond were part of a colossal morgue, taking in nearly 500 corpses a day in the wake of the Nazi retreat. The dead bodies were lined up on both sides of the open-air halls, feet to the wall, faces close to a meter-wide path that ran between them. Other Milanese walked the galleries of the dead that morning. Old women dressed for grief held black lace shawls across their lips and noses. Younger men guided the quaking shoulders of wives, daughters, and sons. Greenhead blowflies had begun to gather. They whined and buzzed. Pino had to swat at them to keep them from getting at his eyes and ears. The flies swarmed the nearest body, a man in a business suit. He'd been shot through the temple. Pino looked at him no more than a second, but the image seared in his brain. The same happened when he looked at the next corpse, a woman in her 50s, dressed in her night clothes, a lone curler still clinging to her iron-gray hair. Back and forth he went, scanning the clothes, the sex, the faces, trying to find Mario among them. Pino moved faster now, giving no more than a glance at the naked couples he figured for once prosperous and powerful fascists and their wives. Portly. Older. Their skin had turned pallid and mottled in death. He walked the first gallery to the octagonal intersections of the hallways and took a right. This colonnade, longer than the first, overlooked the cemetery piazza. Pino saw strangled bodies there, hacked bodies, shot bodies. Death became a blur. The sheer numbers were more than he could handle. So he focused on two things. Find Mario. Get out of this place. A short time later, he found his cousin lying among 6 or 7 dead fascist soldiers. Mario's eyes were shut. Flies danced on his head wound. Pino looked around and saw an empty sheet across the hallway. He got it and laid it over Mario's corpse. Now all he had to do was find Uncle Albert and his father and leave. He felt claustrophobic as he ran back toward the chapel. He dodged through the other searchers and got there out of breath and brimming with anxiety. He went through the chapel, barreled down the stairs to the lower colonnades. A family was shrouding a body on his right. When he looked left, his uncle was coming toward him from down the gallery, his lips and nose pressed into the camphor, and his head shaking to and fro. Pino ran to him.
"I found Mario."
Uncle Albert dropped the camphor pouch and looked up at him with piteous, bloodshot eyes.
"Good. Where is he?"
Pino told him. His uncle nodded and then put his hand on Pino's forearm.
"I understand now why you were so upset last night," he said hoarsely. "And I'm so sorry for you. She seemed like such a fine young lady."
Pino's stomach cored out. He'd tried to tell himself Anna wasn't here. But where else? He stared over Uncle Albert's shoulder and down the long gallery behind him.
Where is she? He demanded, trying to push by.
No, Uncle Albert said, blocking the way. You are not going down there. Get out of my way, Uncle, or I'll throw you out of my way.
Albert dropped his eyes, stepped aside, and said,
She's in the far hall, on the right. Do you want me to show you?
No, he said.
Chapter 32
1 Pino found Dolly Stottlemyre first. General Lyris's mistress was still dressed in her ivory gown. Between Dolly's breasts, a chrysanthemum of blood had bloomed, wilted, and dried. Her slippers were gone. Her eyes and mouth were half open, frozen in rigor. Her fingers had died, clutching her thumbs, exposing the red nail polish, making it all the more lurid against the robin's egg color of her skin. Pino looked up then, and saw Anna down the hall. His eyes clouded with tears, and his breath became short and ragged as he tried to keep down the emotion surging everywhere within him, trying to thrash its way out of his chest and through his windpipe. Mouth open, lips moving to form silent words of sorrow, he went and knelt beside her. There was a bullet hole below Anna's bra, and a flower of blood on her exposed belly, similar to the one on Dolly. Horror had been written across her brow, in the same red gloss the partisans had used to make her lips look so garish. Pino stared down, engulfed by misery, swallowing against grief and trembling with loss. He lowered the camphor pouch from his lips and nose. Breathing in the ungodly putrid air in the hallway, he untied the pouch and put the camphor aside. He used the handkerchief to wipe the lipstick from her brow and from about her lips, until she was almost the Anna he remembered. He set the handkerchief down, clasped his hands, and gazed at her, as he sucked in the smell of her death, drawing it deep into his lungs.
I was there, Pino said. I saw you die, and I said nothing, Anna. I did.
The pain threw tears from his eyes and doubled him over.
What did I do? He moaned. What did I do?
Tears dripped off his cheeks as he rocked back and forth on his haunches and stared down at the wreckage of his love.
I failed you, Pino choked. Christmas Eve, you were there to stand by me, come what may, and I wasn't there for you. I don't know why. I can't even explain it to myself. I wish I'd stood against the wall with you, Anna.
He lost track of time as he knelt there by her, vaguely aware of people moving past him, glancing at Anna's chopped hair and making comments about her under their breath. He didn't care. They couldn't hurt her now. He was there, and they couldn't hurt her any further. 2. Pino? He felt a hand on his shoulder and looked up to find his father and uncle there.
We were supposed to have everything, Papa, Pino said in bewilderment. Our love was supposed to be forever and ever. We didn't deserve this.
Michele was tearing up.
I'm so sorry, Pino. Albert's only just told me.
We're both so sorry, his uncle said. But we have to go, and I hate to tell you this, but you have to leave her now.
Pino wanted to rise up and beat his uncle to a pulp.
I'm staying with her.
You're not, Michele said.
I've got to bury her, Papa. Make sure she has a funeral.
You can't, Uncle Albert said. There are partisans checking who's claiming the bodies. They'll think you were a collaborator, too.
I don't care, Pino said.
We do, Michele said firmly. I know this is hard, son, but...
Do you?
Pino screamed.
If this were Mama, would you leave her?
His father cringed and stepped back. No, I... Uncle Albert stopped him. Pino, it's what Anna would want.
How do you know what Anna would want?
Because I saw in her eyes how much she loved you that Christmas Eve at the shop. She would not want you to die because of her. Pino looked down at Anna again, choking back emotion.
But she won't get a funeral, a headstone, anything.
Uncle Albert said, I asked the man in the chapel what happens to the unclaimed bodies, and he said they'll all be blessed by Cardinal Schuster, cremated and buried. Pino's head swung slowly back and forth.
But where will I go to...
See her? His father said. You go to where you were both happiest, and she'll always be there. I promise you that. Pino thought of that small park in Chernobyl, at the southwest end of Lake Como, where he and Anna had stood at the rail, and she'd taken his picture wearing the headband, and everything had seemed perfect. He looked down at Anna's cold face. Leaving her seemed a second betrayal, one with no possibility of forgiveness. Pino, his father said softly.
I'm coming, Papa.
He sniffed and wiped his eyes with the handkerchief, smearing some of her lipstick on his face, and then tucked the tear-stained hanky in her bra.
I loved you, Anna, Pino thought. I'll love you forever and ever.
Then he leaned over, kissed her, and said his goodbye. 3. Pino stood, wobbly. With his uncle and father holding on to each elbow, he left and did not look back. He couldn't. If he did, he swore he'd never move again. By the time they returned to the chapel, Pino could walk without their help. He was already trying to get the image of her corpse out of his head by recalling Anna in Dolly's kitchen the night after he'd saved the general's life, and how she told him about her childhood birthday mornings with her father out on the sea. That memory carried him through the rest of the process of shrouding Mario and moving him out of the upper gallery to the partisans checking the bodies. They recognized Mario's uniform for what it was and waved them through. They found a cart and pushed the corpse through the city to an undertaker who was a friend of the family. They didn't make it home until after dark. Pino was spinning from exhaustion, from grief, from lack of food and water. He forced himself to eat, and he drank too much wine. He went to bed the way he had the night before, with the shortwave tuned to static. He closed his eyes, praying that he'd see Anna alive again in his dreams. But she wasn't alive there. Not that night. In Pino's dreams, Anna was dead and lying alone in the lower galleries of the Cimitero Monumentale. Behind his eyelids, Pino could see her, as if lit from above in a dark place. Every time his dream self tried to get closer to her, however, she slipped farther and farther away. The cruelty of it made him cry out in pain. Pino startled alert into the waking nightmare of Anna being gone all over again. He gasped and held his sweating head for fear of its bursting. He tried to clear his thoughts of Anna but could not, and he could not sleep. That was done. He could either lie here while memories and regrets ripped him up, or he could walk and let movement calm his mind, as it had since he was a boy.
Pino checked his watch. It was 3 o'clock a.m. on Sunday, April 29th, 1945. 4. He dressed and slipped out of the apartment, took the stairs, and went out through the empty lobby. The night was dark, and the street lamps infrequent as he drove through San Babila, heading north, retracing much of the route they'd used to bring Mario's body to the funeral home. At 4:10, Pino was back at the Cimitero Monumentale. Partisans stopped him, checked his papers. He told them his fiancée was inside. Someone had seen her body there.
"How are you going to see her?" one of the guards asked.
Another guard lit a cigarette. Pino said, "Could you give me 3 of your matches?"
"No." "Come on, Luigi," the first guard said. "The kid's trying to find his dead sweetheart, for Christ's sake."
Luigi took a deep drag, sighed, and flipped Pino the box. "Bless you, signore," Pino said, and hurried across the piazza toward the colonnades. Rather than walk among the corpses, Pino looped around to a door that took him to the long hallway where Anna lay. When he got to where he thought she'd been, he lit a match and shone it around. She wasn't there. He looked about, tried to get his bearings, and thought he might be short. The match went out. He walked another 3 meters and lit another match. She wasn't there. No one was there. The gallery floor was empty for at least 12 meters on either side of where she'd been. The unclaimed bodies were gone. Anna was gone. The finality of it felt smothering. He sank against the wall there and sobbed until he could not cry anymore. When Pino at last trudged down the steps from the memorial chapel, he felt the burden of her death like a yoke that could never be shed.
"Find her?" the guard asked.
"No," Pino said. "Her father must have gotten here first. A fisherman from Trieste." They exchanged glances. "Sure," Luigi said. "She's with her papa." 5. Pino wandered aimlessly through the city, skirting the central train station, now heavily guarded by partisan forces. He got turned around in an unlit area, had no idea where he was at one point, but then dawn began to glow across rippling low clouds, and he could soon see well enough to realize he was northwest of Piazzale Loreto and Beltramini's fresh fruits and vegetables. He ran and got to the fruit stand in the first good light of day. He pounded on the door, called out toward the upstairs window.
"Carletto? Carletto, are you there? It's Pino!"
He got no answer. He kept pounding and calling, but his friend did not reply. Despondent, Pino walked south. It wasn't until he'd walked past the telephone exchange that he understood where he was going and why. 5 minutes later, he cut through the kitchen of the Hotel Diana and pushed on through the double doors into the ballroom. There were American GIs and Italian women passed out here and there. Not as many as 2 mornings before, but empty bottles were everywhere, and broken glass on the floor crunched under his shoes. He looked into the hallway that led to the lobby. Major Frank Neville was there, sitting at a table against the wall. He was drinking coffee and looking very hungover. "Major?" Pino said, walking toward him. Neville looked up and laughed.
"Pino Lella, the boogie-woogie kid. Where the hell have you been, buddy? All the girls have been asking for you."
Pino didn't know where to begin. "Can I talk to you?" The major saw the seriousness in his eyes and said,
"Sure, kid, pull up a chair."
But before Pino could,
a boy about 10 years old burst in the front door and yelled in broken English,
Il Duce, Major K! They bring the Mussolini to Piazzale Loreto!
Now? Major Nebel said, getting up fast. Are you sure, Victor?
My father, he hears this.
Let's go, Nebel said to Pino. Pino hesitated, wanted to talk to the major, to tell him.
Come on, Pino, you'll be a witness to history, the American said. We'll take the bikes I bought yesterday.
6. Pino felt a break in the fog of Anna's death and nodded. He'd wondered what would become of Il Duce the last time he saw him in Cardinal Schuster's office, when Mussolini was still praying for Hitler's superweapon to be unleashed, and still hoping for a bed in the Führer's secret Bavarian bunker. By the time they'd grabbed two bikes Nebel had stashed behind the registration desk and exited the hotel, other people were running toward Piazzale Loreto, crying,
They've got him! They've got Il Duce!
Pino and the American major jumped on the bikes, pedaled hard. Other bikes soon joined them, racing and waving red scarves and flags, all of them lusting to see the dictator now that he'd been deposed. They rode past Beltramini's fresh fruits and vegetables and into Piazzale Loreto, where a thin crowd was already gathering around the Esso station and the girders Pino had stood on to witness the execution of Tullio Galimberti. Pino and Major Nebel put the bikes aside and went forward to see four men clambering up onto the girders. They carried ropes and chains. Pino followed the American as he fought his way to the front of the growing crowd. 16 bodies lay there by the petrol pumps. Benito Mussolini was in the middle, barefoot, his massive head resting on his mistress's chest. The puppet dictator's eyes were vacant and opaque, the madness Pino had seen in them at the villa on Lake Garda just a memory. Il Duce's upper lip was pulled back, baring his teeth, and making him look as if he were about to launch into one of his tirades. Claretta Petacci sprawled beneath Mussolini, with her head turned away from her lover, as if being coy. Some of the partisans in the crowd were saying that Mussolini had been having sex with his mistress when the executioners arrived. 7. Pino looked around. The crowd had quadrupled, and there were more coming, throngs from every direction, like a chorus gathering on a stage at the end of a tragic opera. Shouting, angry, they all seemed to want to wreak personal vengeance on the man who'd brought the Nazis to their doors. Someone put a toy scepter in Mussolini's hand. Then a woman old enough to have been the crone in Dolly's apartment building waddled out. She squatted over Il Duce's mistress and pissed on her face. Pino was repulsed, but the crowd went feral, sinister, and depraved. People were laughing hysterically, cheering and feeding on the anarchy. Others began shouting for more desecrations, while ropes and chains were being rigged. A woman darted forward with a pistol and put 5 rounds in Mussolini's skull, which provoked another round of jeers and catcalls to beat the bodies, to tear the flesh from their bones. 2 partisans fired their guns into the air to get the mob back. Another tried to turn a fire hose on them. Pino and Major Nebel had retreated by then, but others kept pressing toward the bodies, eager to vent their rage.
Hang them!
A voice in the chorus cried.
Get them up to where we can see them! Put the hooks into their hocks!
Others sang.
String them up like pigs!
Mussolini went up feet first, head and arms dangling below the girder. Those in the ever-growing mob went insane. Cheering, they stamped their feet, threw their fists high, and brayed their approval. Il Duce had been beaten so badly by then, his skull was caved in. He looked beyond grotesque, a figment in a nightmare and nothing like the man Pino had spoken to repeatedly over the past year. They hoisted Claretta Petacci up next. Her skirt fell below her breasts, revealing that she wore no panties. When a partisan chaplain climbed up beside her to tuck the skirt up between her legs, he was pelted with trash. Four more bodies were strung from the girders, all high-ranking fascists. The desecrations went on in the building heat, until the barbarity finally broke through Pino's grief-dazed state and sickened him. He felt dizzy, nauseated, and thought he might faint. A man was brought forward. His name was Starace. They placed Starace beneath the hanging corpses of Mussolini and his mistress. Starace gave the straight-arm fascist salute, and six partisans shot him dead. The bloodthirsty chorus in Piazzale Loreto sang deliriously and called for more, but seeing Starace shot caused Pino to reel off into the memory of Anna's dying. He thought he might go mad and join the mob. "This is how tyrants fall," Major Neville said, disgusted. "That would be the lead if I were writing this story. This is how tyrants fall." "I'm going to leave, Major," Pino said. "I can't take this anymore." "I'm with you, buddy," Neville said. 8. They pushed their way back through a crowd that had grown to 20,000 or more. It wasn't until they were across from the fruit stand that they could walk easily against the grain of more and more people coming to Piazzale Loreto to pay their disrespects. "Major," Pino said, "I need to talk to you.
You know, kid, I've been meaning to talk to you since you showed up this morning,"
Neville said as they crossed the street. The door to Beltramini's fresh fruits and vegetables was open now. Carletto stood in the doorway, looking green with a hangover. He smiled wanly at Pino and the American.
"Another drag-the-knuckle night, Major," Carletto said.
"That's knuckle-dragger," Neville said with a laugh. "But even better, I've got the both of you at once."
"I don't understand," Pino said.
"Would you boys be willing to help America?" the Major asked. "Do something for us? Something tough? Something dangerous?"
"Like what?" Carletto asked.
"I can't tell you right now," Neville said. "But it's vital, and if you pulled it off, you'd have a lot of friends in the United States. Ever thought of going stateside?"
"All the time," Pino said.
"There you go," the Major said.
"How dangerous?" Carletto asked.
"I won't BS it. You could get killed."
Carletto thought about that, then said, "Count me in." Feeling his heart race with a strange mania, Pino said, "I'm in too."
"Excellent," Neville said. "Can you get a car?"
Pino said, "My uncle has one, but it's up on blocks and the tires won't go far."
"Uncle Sam will take care of the tires," he said.
"Get me the keys and an address where the car is, and I'll see it's ready and waiting for you at the Hotel Diana, 3 a.m., day after tomorrow, May 1st, okay?"
Carletto said, "When will we know what we're doing?"
"3 a.m., day after..." Neville stopped. They all heard the tanks then. The roar of diesels, the treads clanking. As they poured into Piazzale Loreto, Pino saw war elephants in his mind.
"Here come the Shermans, buddies!"
Major Neville crowed, throwing his fist overhead.
"That's the U.S. Fifth Army Cav. As far as this war goes, the fat lady's singing."
Part 5. "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord." Chapter 33. Tuesday, May 1st, 1945. 1. As Pino and Carletto neared the Hotel Diana at 2:55 a.m., they were almost as drunk as they'd been before passing out just a few hours before. Only now their stomachs were queasy and their headaches blazing. On the other hand, Adolf Hitler was dead,
The Nazi Führer had shot himself in his bunker in Berlin, committing suicide along with his mistress, the day after Mussolini and Patacci